Good afternoon. How is everyone doing? Good lunch? I missed it, so hopefully there'll be some later. My name is Wade Wegner. Today I'm going to be talking to you about building mobile applications with Windows Azure. First off, it looks like the doors are going to be remaining open, so hopefully if anyone can't hear me well throughout the course of the talk, if people are coming in and out, please just let me know. We'll try to fix it. We're going to go ahead and get started. So some quick background on me. I'm the CTO at Aditi Technologies. We're an NSI partner for Microsoft, focused on cloud applications with Windows Azure. I've been a Windows Azure Partner of the Year for the last 3 years. I joined about 4.5 months ago, so I can't claim a lot of credit for being a Windows Azure Partner of the Year, but good company. I came from Microsoft, where I'd been focused on Windows Azure since about 2008. Was a technical evangelist with the Windows Azure team up in Redmond. So I do a couple of things. Feel free to take a look, visit the blog. A lot of the information that I'll be covering today I blogged about in the past, so you can get some additional information. You can find me on Twitter and would love to engage in conversation over time with you, so feel free to find me there. And lastly, everything that I'll be showing today I've put up on GitHub as well. So if you want to take a look at any of the source for the apps that I'm building, I have both the start and the end state for the app. So you can take a look at where I've started, and then also if you just want to jump to the end state, you can take a look at those apps as well up on GitHub. So today we'll be talking about device apps with Windows Azure and why Windows Azure is such a great place for hosting services to enrich your mobile apps. And specifically, we're going to talk about some things related to storage, identity, communications, and some of the other platform services within Windows Azure that you can use for your mobile applications. And I'm going to have a lot of demos. Hopefully, no one here will mind spending some time in Visual Studio. I do have 4 demos with quite a bit of code, so hopefully everyone is excited by that. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about some of these items right here. And if you've built traditional web apps in the past, there are some nuances and differences when it comes to building a mobile application, specifically around storage, identity, and communication. And so these are going to be some of the central pillars for the talk today. Now, before we get into it, a couple of things I do want to mention. Within the last 3 to 4 months, Windows Azure has released some new capabilities within the platform, which are pretty compelling for building mobile applications. The first is Windows Azure Websites, and I spoke about it a little bit at the overview session yesterday. Nathan Totten also gave a very detailed talk about it yesterday, so I'm not going to get into too much depth, but basically, it is a great place for building your web APIs and services that your mobile applications will consume. Given that you have a different deployment model than the traditional cloud service, it's very easy to do iterative development, very easy to make some changes, deploy it up there, and within seconds actually test it from your mobile app. So very, very interesting place. You can not only build ASP.NET apps, but Node.js apps as well as PHP. And one of the nice benefits about it, too, is when you sign up for Windows Azure, you'll get 10 free accounts running as part of Windows Azure Websites. So if you didn't see Nathan's talk yesterday, be sure to check it out. It's a service worth taking a look at. Another service worth taking a look at is Windows Azure Mobile Services. This was announced about 3 weeks ago. Now, it's a little bit different than what we're going to be talking about today, because the intent with Windows Azure Mobile Services is actually to enable UI and UX developers that don't have a lot of experience building back-end services, and frankly, who don't want to build back-end services. Windows Azure Mobile Services will provide everything from simple authentication mechanisms to places to store data, some server logic, notifications, diagnostics, those sorts of things. It's definitely worth taking a look at. If you plan to build your own back end, it may not be the direction you want to take, but at the very least, take a look at it. You may be surprised by some of the capabilities with it. One note before I move on from it is that today it is geared around building Windows 8 applications, and that's just a point in time consideration. Over time, it will open up to other platforms such as iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and the like. So that's Windows Azure Mobile Services. Now, let's start off by talking about storage, because interacting with storage up in the cloud is a little bit different than when you have a service or a website running in the cloud. Now, with Windows Azure, there's a number of storage options. There's the Windows Azure Storage Service, which is a highly scalable, durable storage service that has a number of different data constructs in it. It's got Windows Azure Tables, which provides hierarchical data storage, Windows Azure Blob Storage, which will give you access to place things like various binary data types, so images, videos, and the like. And then there's Windows Azure Queues, as well as Service Bus Queues. And queues are a great way to build distributed applications that can communicate through a queue, so you can enqueue an item and then pick it up somewhere else. There's also Windows Azure SQL Database, which is a related relational database service. So if you're familiar with SQL Server, Windows Azure SQL Database is a relational database service. It's managed for you, it's provisioned for you, but you can use it as a relational database service within your applications. Now, all these are great places, great storage mechanisms to use with Windows Azure, but there's something to consider with mobile applications, and that's that you have to authenticate to each of these. And so one of the challenges with building the mobile app is, how do you authenticate in such a way that you don't put your secrets into your client application? Windows Azure has a concept of a storage name and a storage key, and it uses this information to sign request headers to get authenticated to the storage service. And so traditionally, in a web application, you'd have your storage account name and key, and you just use that as part of the client API to sign your request so you get access to the storage service. This doesn't work so well with a mobile app because then you'd have to put that key on the device. And the risk there is that someone will end up reverse engineering or peek into your application and extract your storage name and storage key. So we want to end up avoiding that. Similarly with it's been rebranded, Windows Azure SQL Database, you have a connection string. And we want to avoid putting that connection string into the client application because then people can get access to it. So there's a couple of different ways we can go about doing this. And it's probably not going to surprise you, but one of the more traditional ways to do it is to simply proxy the requests. And what I mean by that is we've got a scenario where we've got our mobile client application, and we have a service that we run somewhere up in the cloud, Windows Azure Cloud Services or Windows Azure website. And that service will end up having our stored secrets in the service, so no one has access to that service. The client app will then communicate to the service, and the service can then proxy the requests to the storage service. So it looks a little something like this. Client app makes a request to our service, and it'll end up proxying it to the storage service itself. Again, the reason for doing this is the client secrets won't end up being in the device. This works with SQL Azure as well, where you can end up making the request to your service, you can query the database, and of course you can get the response back and send it to the service. So putting the secrets and keeping them up in the cloud is a tactic that's well worth looking at because it allows us to keep the secrets off of the device app. Now, there's another way to go about doing this as well, because in many cases, you don't always want to proxy your requests. Imagine a case where you're taking pictures or video from your mobile device, and you're going to be uploading that somewhere up in the cloud. Some of these media items can be large, and we don't want to always proxy them, because that means potentially two hops for when we're uploading our data. So there's another mechanism called a shared access signature with Windows Azure that you can use so that you can address the storage service directly without having to put the key on the device. And it looks something like this. We'll end up still making a request to our service, but our service, rather than proxying the request back to the storage service, will generate this shared access signature. And essentially what this is, and I'll give you guys a demonstration of it in a moment, but it's simply a URL with some encoded information in it. And it's going to send that URL back to the device, so that the device can then use it to address the storage service directly. And the storage service can look at the information in that URL and validate that it was actually created using our storage name and our storage key. So then that way the storage service can actually give us access and then return some data. So a shared access signature is a great way to get around having to use these proxying services in case we have larger pieces of data. And so I'm going to go ahead and show two demos here. The first one is going to be showing you a very simple shared access signature service that you can use with your mobile applications. It's all REST, so I'll demonstrate it using Windows Phone, but it works just as well with iOS, Android, and other device platforms. The second demo that I'm going to show you is how we can then leverage something like this shared access signature service to build a simple application that can take an image and a picture, upload it into Blob Storage, and then store it in a Windows Azure table. So let me go ahead and switch over. And I'll get started. All right, so The first app that I have here is it's an ASP.NET web application. It's a MVC4 app, .NET 4.5. It doesn't really matter what the framework is. This will work in any at least .NET 4, .NET 4.5. And what I've done is I've installed a NuGet package. Hopefully everyone here is familiar with NuGet. I've installed specifically the Windows Azure Storage NuGet package. So you can see that right here. And what this NuGet package does is it provides me with a .NET client API that I can use for interacting with the storage service. And so in this app, I have ASP.NET web API, and I've done a couple of things. I've essentially written a method or a controller that will respond back with a shared access signature. And in most cases, you're going to want to provide some information about the resource that you're either uploading or that you're trying to retrieve. So you can see here that I'll pass along the blob name as well as the content type so that I know if I'm uploading a resource, if it's a JPEG, if it's a video, and so forth. And then just so that I can demonstrate this through the browser, I've created a simple method here that allows me to just call a get, and it's going to look for that particular image and pass along that blob type. Now, before I run it, what I want to show is I've got a Windows Azure Storage account. It's called TechEd AU Demos, and in it I've also got a container. It's called Pix. And this container right now is set to be private. And what that means is if I take a look at here, there's no policy, and it's not open to the public. So the access control on it is private. So if I try to access any of these resources directly, I won't be able to get to them. So I'm going to grab here the URL that goes directly to that resource, and I'll try to browse to it. And it'll actually say this specified resource doesn't exist. So the storage service is passing back a message saying it's not found. And that's because it's a private resource. The same thing would happen from a mobile device if I tried to access this resource. So let me show you what we can do in order to actually get access to it without having to use the storage key from within the application. If you take a look at this code, what I've got here is in the method, I'm going to go ahead and create my storage, or I'm going to set up the context to my storage account, passing in my account name and account key. And again, remember, this is the service. This is running up in Windows Azure. This is not the code that's running on the client. It's going to go ahead and create a blob client reference, and then it's going to create a reference to that container. If it doesn't exist, it's going to create it. If it exists, it's just going to end up using that as a reference. And then it's going to go ahead and create this policy. Now, a policy within Windows Azure is a powerful thing because it allows us to grant access to a resource through the policy rather than directly from the resource itself. And this is an important distinction because if something were to happen and someone got access to the URI, the shared access signature, inadvertently, we may want to turn that access off. And so with the policy, you can actually delete the policy so that anyone that's using that shared access signature won't be able to get access to our resources. So the policy is a great way to control access to these private resources. So after creating this policy, I'm going to go ahead and set permissions to the container. So I'm going to set that policy at the container level. We could set the policy also at the individual blob level if we wanted to as well. For this demo, I'm just doing it at the container level. And then the last thing it's doing is it's going to request through the blob container the shared access signature, and then it's going to return it. So what we'll see when we run this is we're going to see a URI that's our shared access signature, and we're going to use that to access the resource. So let me go ahead and run this. And I will API, shared access signature. And you can see here, I'll go ahead and zoom this up a little bit, is the response back, it's XML, you can get JSON if you want to get a JSON response, but it's essentially a URI that we can use to address our resource. So now if I grab this URI and try to get access to the resource, you can see down here it's downloading right down here, and then in a moment it'll be open, and voila, there's a picture actually this is Auckland from last week, TechEd New Zealand. So shared access signature is really nice because, again, my client app doesn't actually have to have the storage account name and key. It uses the shared access signature in order to get access to the resource. So that's a simple demonstration of it. Let's go ahead and highlight something a little bit more complex. And this is going to be a Windows Phone app that's going to use a shared access signature in order to get access to our storage resources. Now, what I've got here is a simple application. Right now, it has nothing to do with Windows Azure. Let me go ahead and just run this. Fit this a little bit better. And simple app, I can go ahead and I give it a name. And then when I click upload, what it's going to do is allow me to take a picture. So it's using the camera capture task within Windows Phone. It's going to take the picture, and then it'll do something with it. And so what we're going to do is wire it up so that after we take the picture, it'll upload it into Windows Azure Storage securely, put it in a blob container, and then it's going to write an item or a pointer into tables for us, Windows Azure Tables. And then that way we can use the data in Windows Azure Tables to bind to a control and actually list out the images that we've uploaded. So let me go ahead and get started here. Now, to do this, the very first thing I'm going to do is install a NuGet package that gives me a client API for Windows Phone that allows me to interact with the Windows Azure Storage Service. So this is very similar to the Windows Azure.Storage NuGet package that gave us access through our web API project. This one is one, though, that runs on Windows Phone. So I'm going to use NuGet to install phone.storage, which is the NuGet package. This is actually provided by the technical evangelism team at Microsoft, for the Windows Azure technical evangelism team. Oh, a new version of NuGet's there. So now that I've installed that, you can see it's got a reference here to phone.storage. Now I'm going to go ahead and start using that within the application. In my main page, I've got, you can see here, a camera capture task completed. So once it's captured the picture, this event will fire. And I want to go ahead and, if we have an image, upload this into blob storage. And rather than you guys watch me try to type all this out, I've got a snippet here for it. And I'll explain to you what this is doing. It's very similar to the previous code. We're going to get a reference to the blob client and the container. And if the container doesn't exist, we're going to create it. And once it's there, we're going to take the stream, the image stream, and actually upload that into the container. Once it's done, we're going to get a response back. So we have here a delegate that we're going to be able to run. And now we want to then take the URI for the blob that was just created and write this into table storage. So this is also very similar. We've got storage context for tables. We're going to have an object, a CLR object, that we'll construct called sample data in this case. It could be anything. And that's what we're going to end up writing. And then we're going to add that up into Windows Azure Table Storage. Now, let me go ahead and set up this sample data class. And again, go ahead and use the snippet. Now, this is identical to the way it works within the Windows Azure Storage client API. Essentially, we're going to be using a data service entity, and it's going to be a table service entity which specifies the partitioning scheme for Windows Azure Table Storage. And in it, you'll see a partition key. And we're going to base this just on a date time ticks as well as a GUID. And then we're going to specify along with this just a name and a URL. So these are going to be things uploaded into the Windows Azure Table Storage. Let's go ahead and build this. Now, the last thing I want to do, this is going to handle the uploading of the resource into blobs, into tables. I also want to create a page that will list out all the resources that I've uploaded as well. So here I've got a list items page that all it has right now is just a list box that we're going to use to bind to. And in here I've got the loaded event. So on loaded, what it's going to end up doing is querying Windows Azure Table Services. It's going to use, again, the sample data, and then it's just going to end up binding it, and we're going to bind it to our item source for the list. And so that'll list out all the resources that we have in there. Now let me go ahead and run this. Right now, what I'm doing is I'm using the local storage emulator. So you notice that I actually haven't specified a storage account or a key, and I don't have a service yet running. So this is just still at dev time. Let's go ahead and get this running. So I'm going to start this up. And this time, when I upload, I'm going to say image1.jpg. We'll capture that. And if we take a look at our local development storage, we now have a Pix container. So that was actually created through the upload process. Remember, it creates if not exist. And in that container, we have image one. So that's the image we just took off the phone. And if I open it up, you'll see that Windows Phone creates wonderful, wonderful sample pictures with the camera capture task. So that's good, but the problem here now is we're just using local storage. And we could switch this to go directly to our Windows Azure storage service, but then we'd be putting the account name and the key in the device. So what we want to do next is create a service that will handle this for us, generate the shared access signature, and pass it back to the device. So I'm going to go ahead and stop this and create a new ASP.NET application. And I'm just going to create a .NET, ASP.NET MVC, actually I'll do an MVC3 application. One thing to note right now is Windows Azure only supports .NET Framework 4.0 running up in cloud services and websites. I'm sure this will change soon once they exit validation testing and so forth. But if you build a .NET 4.5 application and try to deploy it today, unless you ship the framework with it, it's not going to end up running. So make sure you target .NET 4 today. I'll go ahead and add this. I'm just going to create a, just a basic internet app. And I'm going to use another NuGet package that provides this shared access signature that Microsoft ships, and it's called the Windows Azure.Storage Proxy NuGet. So once this is created, let's go ahead and switch this to our MVC app. Windows Azure.Storage.Proxy. And again, this is going to add both the Windows Azure storage NuGet as well as a set of proxy services that will handle the shared access signatures for us. Now, by default, this NuGet package is also set up to use local storage. But what we're going to do is change our Windows Phone app to point to this service so that the phone itself now is always going to be communicating through the service in order to upload this binary data, the pictures, as well as writing to table storage. So the first thing I want to do is I'm just going to switch this to an IIS Express app so that it actually ends up running properly. And then I want to grab the port number because I'm going to be updating the phone app to call to it at this port. So let's grab this port. Make sure everything builds. And then when we installed the phone.storage NuGet package, what it did is it also created this resource called the Storage Initializer. And this is a really handy resource for us from a development perspective because it means that for us developers, we don't have to change how we interact with the storage API. We can just change how the storage service resolves through this resolver. By default, it's using local development storage right here. So it's resolving to the local storage service that's running on my machine. What I can do, though, is change this so that instead of using that resolver, we're going to point it to the service we just created. So here it's going to run through a proxy, and we're going to point it to localhost at port 36427. So that's going to point to the MVC app that we just created. Go ahead and build this. And now I'm going to run our service first. So we'll run the service. And then we're going to start up our phone app. Now, our phone app, again, is not going to be talking directly to storage. It's going to start proxying through the service that we've created and using the shared access signatures in order to upload the resources. And now when I start the phone app, we'll do the same demo. And then this time, it's going to use the service instead of talking to storage directly. So I can change this to image JPEG, image 2 JPEG, take the picture. And then if we look again at local dev storage, we have image 2, but this time we went through the storage service. Now, that might not be all that impressive since we're still writing local, so let's take it that next step. Let's update now our service to write to an actual Windows Azure storage account instead of writing to local storage. So we'll go ahead and stop. And this time, instead of modifying the phone app, we're going to modify the storage service. So we've got this storage service here, and you can see by default it's using local development storage. What we want to do is instead of having this resolve to local development storage, we're going to have it point to an actual storage service. So I won't show the whole account key, but you can see here this is a very traditional way of specifying your account name. So here we got TechEd AU demos, and then I've got my account key here now as well. So the service has the credentials, the phone app doesn't. So let's run it again, and this time when I upload, we've just changed the service, and but instead of writing to local dev storage, it'll write it up to Windows Azure. So we've got that running. Let's start the phone. Actually, I don't even need to redeploy the phone app. I'll just go ahead and run it again, because we didn't change anything on the phone app. And when I run, type image3.jpg and upload it. Now what we'll do is we'll take a look here under pics, and you can see here it just wrote at 2:10 and 33 seconds, image 3, and this is the image that we just captured from the device. And I just realized I never actually showed the page that queries the table, and you can see here it's showing image 3 three times. I don't know why that's the case. But we can end up querying that table as well. Oh, I think it's, I'm not sure why it's showing that. But so the whole point here is, again, we were able to switch the service now to go to our cloud storage service without having to change the phone device. So the phone doesn't have the account name and key on the device. It's using the shared access signature to get access to the storage service. So hopefully that validates or at least reinforces some of the concept about taking the credentials and moving them off of the device and using a service instead. Now, moving on, the next topic is identity. And identity can be a tricky one for a device, and there's a lot of different ways that you can go about tackling it. One of the probably more traditional ways to do it is to roll your own and to use maybe the stored or the membership provider model with .NET, or really just writing your own. And this means that you're managing usernames, passwords. You have to have a create account process, probably recover your password, forgot password, all these sorts of things. And this can work well, but it just means that as a user, as a consumer of your application, I have to create another account, and now you are responsible for managing it, which also means making sure that you're managing it securely so that in case something does happen and there's a breach, my password doesn't end up getting out in the public. You've got to protect that. So creating your own is certainly something that's possible, but it's a little bit more involved than maybe you might want it to be. Another very valid approach is to use an existing identity provider. And this could be everything from Active Directory to a Google ID to Live ID to Facebook and so forth. And this works really well. Now you're not responsible for managing and persisting that identity, but there's a couple of the things that you do need to do, including developing against that identity provider's API. And if anyone here has done any Facebook development over the several years, you'll know that these APIs can change a lot. And then it's your responsibility to go through an update to work with that API. And the other problem with it is that someone may not use the identity provider that you select. So if you build an application that just uses Facebook for authentication, there are, believe it or not, some people that don't have Facebook accounts. So that's certainly an option, but it can end up also coming with some problems as well. Now, a third option is to actually outsource the identity management entirely to a third party. And the Access Control Service is actually really good for this, because the Access Control Service will allow you to federate with multiple identity providers, both social as well as corporate, and build your application against a consistent set of claims. Regardless of the identity provider, Access Control Service will map the claims that come from that identity provider to a consistent set of claims that you can program against. So even if things change with Facebook or Live ID or Google or something else, you're still interacting with the claims that come back from the Access Control Service. And just to reinforce this, security and identity can be a lot of work for any application. You've got authentication, authorization, user stores, protection, management, forgetting passwords, customer support, all these things that you need to take into consideration when building your phone app. And it also opens up a lot of different points of attack where you have to make sure that these things work well. So moving your application to something like ACS and making it claims aware means that you're creating a consistent way of interacting with elements of this identity, so you have a claim that you end up using. And there are also some tools that you can use along with this. So with .NET, you have the Windows Identity Foundation, which makes interacting with these claims pretty straightforward and pretty simple. So what I'm going to do is show a demonstration of how with Windows Phone, we can use the Access Control Service to control access to our APIs so that we first require users to authenticate through Access Control Service. And then after they've authenticated, we're actually going to validate that the token that they provide is in fact the real token provided by the access control service. We want to make sure that they actually were authenticated rather than just providing some kind of a token. So I'm going to switch back here. And go ahead and open up an application that I've got here. Now, for those of you that actually may know me, you might know that one of my hobbies and passions is brewing beer. So I've been a home brewer for several years. And so what I've got here is a sample app that actually will just return some beers. And it's an API that will return back some information. In this case, it's actually some of the beers that I tried when I was in New Zealand. Actually, some very, very good ones there. And you can see it's just a simple XML that comes back. And I've built a phone app around it as well, so that right now it's all unauthenticated. And so if I run the phone app, it'll just grab the response, and it's actually requesting it as a JSON string. And it's just going to end up binding it within the application. So you can see it's right here. So now this is all anonymous. There's no authentication, no authorization around it. And so what we're going to do is take a few steps to secure the web service or the API, and then we'll update the phone app so that we first log in and pass along an OAuth token to the service so that we can authenticate the user. So go ahead and stop this. And the first thing I'm going to do is actually configure the access control service. Now, if you've used the Windows Azure and you've gone to the portal, you've probably seen the new preview portal. This is still in preview mode, but it's a great portal. It's HTML, and it is the portal that's going to be used moving forward. Today, it actually does not have access. You can't get access to the access control service, so you need to flip over to the actual production portal, which is built in Silverlight, and that'll let you get access to the access control service. Now, from here, what you want to do is create a service namespace, and that represents your slice of the access control service. So this is what you're going to interact with when you want to set up your identity providers, your realms, and these sorts of things. It's pretty quick. It takes about 30 to 60 seconds to create the service namespace. I've gone ahead and created one in advance. I haven't done anything with it yet. It's a brand new service namespace, but rather than waiting 30 to 60 seconds, it's already set up, and we can start using it. Now, before we start using it, there's a couple of things that we're going to configure within the access control service, and that'll allow us to build our phone application around it. What we'll do first is set the identity providers that we'll use. So I'm going to specify Google, and then Yahoo as well. So what this means now is for my phone app, there's going to be three different identity providers that we can use. We can use Google, Windows Live ID, or Yahoo. The next thing I do is set up a relying party. And this will be how I interact and interact with the access control service. If I create and add a new one, I'm going to just give it a name of phone app. And then I need to have a realm that I specify from within it. And so I'll just end up, this is just a URI that we'll use. We'll call that phone. There's a number of different token formats supported by the access control service. For the phone app, we're just going to use OAuth or simple web tokens, which will return back an OAuth token to us. So I'll switch this to simple web token. And then I need to create a signing token, something that the access control service will use to sign the token before it sends it to me, so that I can then validate that the token, in fact, came from the access control service. And we'll see where this comes into play a little bit later. So we'll create that signing token. I'm going to go ahead and store it just here in Notepad for now so that I have quick access to it later. We'll save this. And then once our realm is created, or our relying party is created, we're going to add some rules to it. Now, rules within the access control service end up being used to map claims that come from an identity provider to the claims that we use within our application. And you can do this by hand if you want to. It's also pretty easy to generate some of the default claim mappings from identity providers. So I can go ahead and just say, you know, create the default rules, such as mapping email address to email address, name to name, and so forth. So we'll generate those and save those. And that's it. That's all we need to do right now to configure the access control service. We've set up a realm, we specified our identity providers, and then we've ended up setting up the rules that map claims from the identity provider to the claims that we'll use within our application. And now we can start using this within the application. So the first thing I'll do now is, now that we've configured it, is I'm going to modify our web API application. And I'm going to use something called a delegating handler within ASP.NET Web API. to check the token in the request before we start actually calling the service. And the delegating handlers are really nice because it's a way to get up in front of the get to the top of the stack before the whole context of the message is loaded. So it's a very performant way to start reading information out of the request to make some decisions about what you want to what it is that you want to do. So essentially, I'm going to set here and add a message handler called a token validation handler, which doesn't exist, so we'll go ahead and create it. And the token validation handler is going to derive from delegating handler, which is part of system.net.http. And then it's got a method called sendAsync on it, which essentially what it will end up doing is overriding the loading of the message, and it'll let us take a look at the request as it's coming in. So let's go ahead and get this set up. You can see here it allows us to get access to the request, and we can also decide not to process the information and send back a cancellation token if we want to. And so by default right now it's not doing anything. So what we want to do is take a look at the request header that's coming in and extract the OAuth token that our application is providing, check to make sure it's a valid token, and then actually validate it against the access control service to make sure that it was signed by the access control service using our signing, using essentially this secret right here. Essentially the first thing we'll do, and I've got a snippet for it, is it's going to grab out of the request headers the authorization value that's passed in, load that into auth header, and then it's going to do a check to make sure that it's got this OAuth, it specifies OAuth as the bearer token type. So this is by convention. We're going to check to make sure that it specifies OAuth since we're going to be working with this OAuth token. The next thing we want to do is, once we have the token, actually check that the token, in fact, came from the access control service. So I'm going to use a library that a gentleman named Matthias Wolski has created that is pretty handy, and he's open sourced it. It's useful. It's just called the Simple Web Token. I can type. And this is going to drop in a class that we can use to actually validate that token. Oops, apologies. Switch this. Try it again. So now that that's installed, we'll go ahead and build it. You can see here it it created this, this federated identity infrastructure simple web token validator. And then here where we have our token, we're going to go ahead and use that validator and call validate token on it. And in order to do that, we need to take the signing key right here and put it in our application. Now, the reason we do this is if you take a look at validate token, it's going to use the signing key to actually construct a hash that comes along with the OAuth token and compare the hash that we create to the one that comes along with the OAuth token. And the reason this is a way of validating it is the only two individuals that should have this signing key are our application and our service, along with the access control service. So the access control service will sign using the key. It's going to embed that hash along with the OAuth token that it sends to us, and then we can check it here within the application as well. And it does this in this is HMAC valid. And you can see it'll create a byte array based on using that key, and then it'll compare it to one that's passed along with the OAuth token. So now that these things are set up, if I go ahead and try to hit that service again, so if I start this up, now it's actually going to validate and check to see that I have an authorization header. And you can see it threw the exception here that says the authorization header was not valid. And that's because from the browser, we're not passing along, we don't have a way to attach that OAuth token. So this is actually a really good sign. It means that now we're actually checking for some sort of authorization on our service before we hit it. So now let's update our phone application so that we first log in, and then we take a token that we've been given by the access control service and pass it along to our service. And to do that, I'm going to use another NuGet package that Windows Azure provides called the phone.identity.accesscontrol.basePage. And what this does is it provides a couple of resources for me, including a control that allows me to set up a login for the identity providers that have been specified for ACS, as well as some information that will load the token into the context on the phone so that I can extract it when needed. Now, to use it, I have to update a few things. I'm going to go ahead and the first page that I want to load actually will be this login page instead of the main page. So we'll change this to pages, login page. Then here in the login page, we're going to go ahead and, once someone's logged in, send them back to the main page. And then in order for this to work as well, we need to specify which service namespace we're using within the access control service, as well as the realm that we've set up. So coming back here to ACS, our service namespace here is TechEd AU Demo. So I'm going to put that here. And the realm that we used was URI phone. And so now our phone app knows which realm to use in order to try to authenticate. Now that we've done this, when we hit the app, we're going to first log in. And we need to update our application so that when we try to hit the API, we pass along the OAuth token with the request. And so the first thing we need to do is, I mentioned that NuGet package will load the token into the application context. So here we're going to grab that simple web token that comes back from the access control service. And then we're going to add a request header that's authorization and specifies OAuth as the bearer token type, and then is going to end up passing the raw token along with our request. Let's go ahead and start up our service again. And again, as we expect, the web page is going to be unauthorized. And I'm going to set a breakpoint this time on our validation handler. Put it right here. And then we'll start up our app. I'll set a breakpoint here as well. All right, so with the NuGet package that we use for ACS, you'll see now we have this home realm discovery page. And essentially what it's doing is it's calling out to the access control service and asking what identity providers are available for this realm. I'm going to go ahead and use one of them. I'll use Google. And I have an account here that I've set up, TechEd. I learned long ago not to actually use one of my real logins, since it ends up showing the password. Now, the first time you hit the service namespace, you're going to have to allow access. Essentially, this is Google's way of ensuring that you actually want to send these claims to the access control service. So we're going to go ahead and say allow. It's a one-time only step. Next time we end up doing this, we don't have to do this. And you can see here that now I've got this simple web token. And if I come down to, the header, you can see here is the token. I don't know, I'll try to find another better way to display it, but you can see that there's a raw token now that we have access to that we're going to add as part of the request header that we're going to use when we call the service. And so now the delegating handler, when the service is called, is handling that, and we can, if we step through here, it's going to see, we have an auth header. Here it is right here. And further down, we're going to check to make sure that OAuth is part of it, or the OAuth is the specified bearer token. And if it is, it'll remove it. So we have access directly to the token. And then we're going to end up validating it, in using this validator to make sure that it's actually a valid token. And if we, if we go ahead and let this run, it will end up allowing our service to communicate to it. So we've been able to authenticate, grab the token from the access control service, and then pass that along in with the request header so that our web API validates it and knows it can return back a response. So a little demonstration, going a little bit deeper than, I don't know if you guys have seen this before or tried this yourselves, but shows you how you can start to approach this from building out your web APIs for your phone apps. All of this you can do from iOS and Android devices as well. I'll show you where the resources are that you can use. It's not quite as easy, I would say, is doing it with NuGet and some of these APIs. But again, all of this is done just through HTTP. ACS is all HTTP requests back and forth. OAuth is a token format. Plenty of libraries for parsing OAuth tokens in iOS and Android. And then it just makes standard HTTP requests to our service. All right. We'll switch back here to the slides. Now, in terms of different forms of communication from phone apps, there's really two different types, or at least I would propose that there's two different types. One are device-initiated communication. So you guys saw a lot of this with the demonstrations I did. Essentially, it's calling out to a service. So it could be handling an event, or it could be view model changing. But essentially, it's the application calling out to a service that you're running and returning back some data. Another way to do it, though, is through cloud-initiated communications. So this would be your push notifications. Now, as we start talking about different ways to push things back and forth, one of the things you need to consider is, the message type that you're going to be using, the wire formats, and so forth. And some of the reason that this is important is if you take a look at, for instance, some of the different wire formats, some lend themselves really well to cellular networks and some don't. OData, for instance, this is for the OData, the REST XML, and the JSON objects here, it's the same data being passed back and forth, but you can see how verbose OData is, and even how verbose REST XML is versus JSON. And so, choosing the right wire format is important just to optimize your use or your communications over the different networks. Now, when it comes to cloud-initiated and push, there's a number of different options, and I think everyone here is probably familiar with push, I don't think I need to explain the concept, but we will talk a little bit about the types, the opportunities, as well as how you can end up using push and kind of what the architecture is. With Windows Phone, there's three different types of pushes that you can do. You can send a toast at the top, which actually will have a flyout that says something or it notifies you of something. You can update tiles. You can flip tile images. You can put some additional text on there. You can put some numbers. And there's also raw notifications. That's my one attempt at humor today. So there are raw notification types as well, which are really interesting because raw notifications can be delivered directly into your application. So you can, if a user is using your application, you can actually update the app as the user is using it, rather than just sending down a toast or a tile notification as well. Now, the way that you set this up is pretty consistent across the different push notification services that are out there. Essentially, what you're going to end up doing is requesting a channel URI or requesting a way of addressing a device in an application from the push notification service, storing it somewhere, and then using that information in order to send it later. So it looks a little bit like this. Before you ever can send a notification, your application will interact with the notification service and request a channel URI. And essentially, it's just a standard way of doing it. The notification service will send back this channel URI. And again, the channel URI is really just a way of addressing your application running on that device. Now, once the application gets that channel URI, you need to have it send it to you so that you know how to send the message to that user and to that device. So your application will then take the channel URI and store it somewhere. Typically, you'll send it to a service, and then that service can store it in Windows Azure Table Storage, SQL database, any place that you really want to. But the point is that you need to get that channel URI. The device has to request it from the service, and then you need to store it somewhere. So once the channel URI is received and you've got it stored somewhere, you can then use it to initiate a message. You'll use the channel URI to send a message through the notification service, and then it will then push down the message to the device. You don't actually push the message yourself to the device. You let the notification service do it instead. So this is a pretty typical, pretty standard design. Windows Phone does it this way. Windows Notification Service for Windows 8 is pretty much the same. There's an additional authentication step in there. But for the most part, it's pretty consistent. Now, combining the device-initiated communications with cloud will actually open up some additional opportunities for you. So there's a way to leverage both of them within your applications. And one of the reasons you might want to do this is when you push a message to a device, the payload is actually pretty limited, so you can't send down a lot of information. So let's say you wanted to send an article or an image or whatever to an application, you're going to be limited by the size of the payload. And so one of the things that you can end up doing is using a cloud-initiated message to actually, you know, to essentially act as a pointer so that the application calls out to one of your services, uses that information to then pull down the message. So it would look something like this. You send a message to a device. It could just be a pointer. Maybe it's a GUID. Maybe it's an ID of some sort. The user can open the application, you know, via Toast or something else, whatever it might be. And once the application gets the information that was sent down through the push, it could then call your service, pass along that information, and then retrieve the actual message. This actually can be pretty useful. The first place I encountered this was when I started sending messages for an application I had built and tried to do UTF-8 encoding on it. And as soon as I did that, of course, the message size ended up being larger, and I couldn't send down much of a message. It actually ended up just being like half of a sentence. And so I ended up starting to use this type of an architecture to actually deliver the full payload to the application. So there are a number of different notification services. There's with Windows 8, there's WNS, which is a Windows notification service. Windows Phone has MPNS, which is the Microsoft push notification service. Apple has APNS, and then for Android, there's C2DM. What I'm going to do is show a demonstration of a Windows Phone application using MPNS in order to actually use that last architecture of initiating a message from the cloud and then handling it by calling out and having your application calling the service to get additional information. So here I've got an application. And again, all of this stuff, too, is up in GitHub. So if you guys want to grab this, it's very, very easy for you to grab it and give it a try. And I've got a phone application down here that we're going to use and request a channel URI and then store it up in Windows Azure Table Storage. In order to do that, we're going to use services running in a web application, which is the MVC project up here at the top. And the MVC application has services to store the channel URI, and then it's also got a simple MVC area or application running in MVC that we can use just to generate the notifications to send the device as well. All these are actually using NuGet packages provided by Microsoft, you can take a look at this and give this a try as well. So I'm going to go ahead and go ahead and run this. So again, the MVC application has this MVC area that you can get to called notifications, and you wouldn't want to use this in production. Really, this notification push notification MVC area is useful for development purposes because it allows us to send messages down to the device, validate that things are working, and it's good for dev tasks and for testing. And then I'm going to run my phone app as well. Now, when you build an app using push notifications, one thing to consider is that you need to allow the user to initiate the request of the channel URI. If you set your application up to just automatically grab a channel URI and send it to you, it won't pass validation to get into the Windows Phone Store. I found that out because I built an app that actually tried to do that, and then they rejected it. So here's the simple app, and if we take a look here at the MVC application, you'll note that, let me just get these things lined up so we can see them both together. You'll see that right now I don't have any channel URIs stored, so I don't have anything to push to. So when our application requests a channel URI, it's contacting MPNS, it's going to get back a channel URI, and as soon as it gets the channel URI, it's going to post it to our service so that we can store it in Windows Azure Table Storage and use it later on to generate a notification. So now I'll reload this page, and you'll see here's the information that was sent to us by our application. It doesn't pass a user ID. It's got the phone application ID. It's got a client ID. And then it's got this channel right here. And this is the actual, zoom in on a little bit. This is the channel URI that allows us to push directly to the application. And so using this app, using this MVC application, what I'm going to do now is I can send some notifications to the app now that we've got a channel URI. So I can send a raw message. And you can see here it ended up being handled by the application, was displayed. So we received our raw notification. I can go ahead and pin this and then send a tile. title. You can flip this to a Windows Azure logo. It was sent down. We should see this update here in a moment. And then there it did. It updated, sent that information down. And then we can also end up sending a toast as well. And we should get the toast. So just a demonstration of how you can end up using Windows Azure and storing these channel URIs up in this case, it's using Windows Azure Table Storage. So if we were to take a look at our local dev store, we'd see here now that we've got some additional information here. So we've got a tile images container. And then if we opened up the Table Explorer and looked at our tables, we would see that we've got an endpoints table. And in it here is the channel that we registered. So this is running locally. Of course, this works in Windows Azure, within the Windows Azure Storage Service as well. All right, so lastly, I want to talk about some additional platform services that are worth taking a look at. These are what Microsoft calls the application building blocks that come along with Windows Azure. We talked a little bit about SQL, Windows Azure SQL Database and storage, but there's a couple of other services worth noting as well. So traffic, there's a Windows Azure Traffic Manager, which gives you the ability to have global load balancing of your applications running up in Windows Azure. And what that means is you can use Traffic Manager, which essentially handles things at the DNS level, to run your applications in multiple data centers and then have it set up such that your users will be directed to the nearest data center. So this gives you some ways of optimizing performance, which is important when it comes to an app running on a cellular network. So the Traffic Manager is great for that. One of the nice benefits of this as well is that it'll not just load balance for performance, but if one of your applications were to go down, it can detect that your application isn't reachable, and it'll start sending your traffic to other services that are still up and available. So you can get some durability built into it as well. There's a distributed in-memory cache that you can use to start loading some information and keeping it in memory so that you're not always calling back to your data tier. So this can help in terms of optimizing response time, which again means that your applications are potentially running faster for your users. I mentioned messaging in terms of queues, so you can build some interesting different application tiers. For instance, you could have worker roles running in the background that are working on the data and then can update things asynchronously. And you can communicate through queues in order to do that. We talked about identity, mobile. There is also Windows Azure Media Services. And what Windows Azure Media Services does is it provides a transcoding service that runs up in Windows Azure that you can use, again, as a service. There was a talk yesterday by a lady from Microsoft about the media services. And you can use this if you wanted to take some of the video that you're capturing from a device and then uploading it to Windows Azure and then kicking off some transcoding services on the video that you've uploaded. So you might want to then transcode it into different formats so that it plays natively on different device platforms, for instance. There's a content delivery network that you can and should use for static images and videos so that your data lives closer to your end users. And then lastly, you can use some networking features, Windows Azure networking, in order to get access to on-premises assets as well. So you can set up your services to communicate to on-premises databases or services or whatever it might end up being using the Windows Azure networking capabilities. Now, so I alluded to some additional tools for other platforms. Most of what I ended up using today were NuGet packages that were built for Windows Phone as part of the Windows Azure Toolkit for Windows Phone. There's also a Windows Azure Toolkit for iOS, which provides Objective-C libraries and Xcode projects that you can use for building iOS applications. If you guys can't read it, sorry, it looks a little small. It's bit.ly/WATIOS, so that should resolve you to the GitHub project where you can get it. And then there's also a set of resources for Android, so Eclipse project along with Java code that handles the access control service interactions as well as providing access to proxy services for storage. So you can take a look at those resources for the other platforms. So that's it. So we talked about different methods for storage, for identity, for communications, and then I gave you a little bit of a teaser for some of the other platform services you should take a look at for mobile apps with Windows Azure. Please do take the time to submit feedback, especially if you enjoyed the session or learned something. I would love to hear from you. Let's see. I think this is pretty cool. I don't know if anyone here has had a chance to actually ride in the helicopter, but you did? Was it worth it?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so everyone tweet something like this so that you also get entered into it to ride in the helicopter. That's pretty cool. So, awesome. So thank you guys very much. Appreciate it. Hope it was worthwhile for you. Thanks.